You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 12th, 9 days away from the rapture in the year 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District, where we are prepared to get all those free lunches if we're lucky enough that the rapture happens sometime during the lunch hour. Evan and Matt have already staked out their positions where they will wait for the rapture so they can swoop in on those free slices of pizza or those, God forbid, dollar burgers. Ladies and gentlemen, today on the program, Siva Vaidyanathan, media studies and law professor at the University of Virginia, will be here to talk about his new book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Be Afraid. And I imagine we'll also touch on this FCC story, which I'll get to in just a moment. But later in the program, a really, really, what's the word? What's that book with the guy fell out of the airplane, but he fell into a haystack. He got out of the haystack, but he stuck into a pitchfork. Good day, bad day. Good news, bad news. Poor Mitt Romney. Folks, this is going to be enjoyable. Mitt Romney, I guess, I don't know if he's announced today, but he's actually going out and making a a major healthcare policy statement, which in fact is really just his way of trying to run from his major healthcare initiative in Massachusetts. We will talk about that. But, you know, do we have time for this clip? We'll get to this clip later. The huckster, Mike Huckabee, has released these cartoons, videos. I sometimes it's just so hard to get you wrap your mind around it. It is, I guess, propaganda, presumably for kids, but maybe just for adult Republicans. Cartoons of Ronald Reagan, and they're just stunning. Meanwhile, John Bonaire also taking it on the chin, both really, I guess, from religious leaders of the two religions he belongs to, the free market fundamentalists have crapped on him today, and the Catholics have crapped on him. That later in the program. But this story, which I really find, this has been one of the most sort of just putrid stories. There's really no other way to describe this. Meredith Atwell Baker, daughter of James Baker, not to be confused, she's one of the two Republican commissioners on the Federal Communications Commission, not to be confused with Michael Powell, who was the son of the Baker's predecessor, not replacement, but held the same position as Baker. His son was the chair of the commission. The FCC seems to be like the place where top government officials put their kids. Like, my kid likes the internet. Is there a job here for them? Oh, yeah, put them on the FCC commission.
used to be FEMA, then they got actual things to do. So
right. No, well, there was nobody who was dumped on FEMA like this. This seems to be like where if you're in government, if you're in a top position, and you got a kid, you're just like, hey, my kid spends all the time in front of the computer. Is there a job around here for them or what? FCC? Great. Great to be an FCC commissioner. That's fantastic. So Meredith Atwell Baker, you remember that she was the one who objected to FCC attempts to impose conditions on the big Comcast NBC University Universal merger. She argued that, quote, the complex and significant transaction, quote, could bring exciting benefits to consumers that outweigh potential harms. She wanted this thing to happen quickly, and now we know why. She has just been hired by, Comcast NBC Universal.
Surprise, surprise.
It's just stunning. Joining FCC Chairman Michael Powell, who's now earning millions as the top lobbyist for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. The FCC has now become like an internship for the kids of politicians so that they can serve an internship and then go get millions of dollars in the industry that they were supposedly going to regulate. No wonder why she wanted this thing to go through fast. She probably had to pay her mortgage. My husband really, I don't know if she's married, but my husband really wants to pick up a hobby. And the only way he can do that is if I start making a ton of money. And so NBC Comcast, that's where I'm going to go. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, Siva Vaidyanathan, media studies and as well as law at the University of Virginia. He will join us to talk about this issue and his book, Googleization of Everything. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Siva Vaidyanathan. He is a media studies and media law professor at the University of Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Bear with me for one second. Before we get into your book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should... worry. Just give me, I imagine you had, I'm going to guess, you had a similar reaction to mine when you read yesterday or this morning that Commissioner Meredith Atwell Baker is leaving the FCC in a month or two to go get a job that I presume is going to pay quite well at NBC U Comcast, which just happen to be able to merge because she, as a commissioner, voted in favor of it.
Well, you know, if these things continue, everybody will have to go work at Comcast NBC. That might be the only media company in a position to hire anybody. You know, I mean, it's not surprising.
But don't you think we should also just, you know, like give up the pretense now? And any FCC commissioner, for them to serve, one of the requirements must be that they also concurrently hold a job. Maybe not just at Comcast, but, you know, anywhere else, anybody that they're going to regulate on.
You know, I mean, this is part of the problem with the regulatory culture in Washington. There's this perception that especially for something so technical as the FCC, you need someone who knows the details and can speak the language. And so you need someone who's basically a media policy lawyer. Those people are going to cycle in and out of a variety of positions on the Hill, at the FCC, or for any of these lobby firms that represent telecom companies, or for the companies themselves. So, it's been going on for a while. It's a pretty blatant example of timing. I mean, she's clearly shameless about it, right? Not even hiding it. So for that, maybe we should give her some credit. That she went ahead and voted on one of the biggest mergers in American history, and then is jumping right away to take a big check. And there are prohibitions about her lobbying the FCC directly for a couple of years. Not that it's going to matter. She's taken with her the deep institutional knowledge of how the FCC works. She's going to be able to serve Comcast, with the pretty high level of insider connections and basic expertise. So, she's exactly the sort of person Comcast needed to hire for that kind of job. I definitely think it's worth following up on just to see, how much contact the company had with her before she actually was in a position to vote on it. I mean, that'll be the big question, I think.
This isn't a McDonald's situation where, they put up a sign and you walk in, you get the job, you start tomorrow. Presumably, for something like this, you would be in conversation for quite a while.
It's a tough thing to show that there was something, really sleazy going on because, these people talk to each other all the time. It's a very small group of communication lawyers in D.C. We're talking about several hundred people who are at the level who can do this job. And they are, after serving in government for a while, going to want to, cash in big time. That's one of the reasons people go to work in these agencies in the first place. I mean, I'm just glad that there's no pretense about it, that she's not surprising us in June when she leaves, that, she's actually telling us ahead of time. I think it's great that we're able to reveal the sort of revolving door so blatantly now. I mean, maybe it's just that people in Washington are just have no more shame about it.
Stunning part. It's just sort of like, I'm going to do this. And I mean, to have just absolutely no sort of compunction about what it's going to do to people's perception, even just, I mean, let's say that even.
Well, that's the thing, it shows no respect for the institution, right? No respect for the FCC as a servant of the public interest. Now, I mean, that's such a weird sentence to even say, the FCC is a servant of the public interest, because, you watch it long enough, it's really hard to imagine it is. Occasionally you get people like Michael Copps, right? Or even Jenikowski, who's the chair currently, who will make clear and strong statements for the public interest and will say, look, I'm here to make sure that, the foundations of the First Amendment work, because information can flow. We can criticize our government and policies, and, we can have a rich cultural life and all that kind of good stuff. But, it's so rare that you get someone who can articulate that case and be above, the give and take of Washington. I think this is a great opportunity to remind people the FCC is supposed to work for us. It so rarely does. Maybe the rest of the commissioners will at least straighten up and fly right for a little while.
Oh, so stunning. But, let's turn from that and, let's talk about your book, The Googleization of Everything, why we should worry. Let's just start with, there's a distinction here between Google and Googleization. Yes?
Yeah. So, this is the thing. What really gets me is the extent to which we've folded Google into our lives, right? I mean, my point on this whole thing is that Google is a company that has to do what's good for Google, right? And Google's brilliant at doing stuff that's good for Google. I think we've made a mistake over the past 10 years of, first of all, sort of blindly inviting the company into our lives in so many intimate ways without really understanding the nature of the transaction, how much we are Googleized, how much information in our world is Googleized. And by that, I mean processed by Google and rendered back to us according to the principles that are baked into Google's computer systems. I mean, nothing about Google is neutral. Google's interested in harvesting as much as it can about human behavior to be able to reinforce, our desires and our habits so that it can sell us stuff through ads, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's what NBC does, right? But the real question is, do we understand it?
Let me, as you say that, I used to be a bit of a situationist fetishist, and I don't know if you're familiar with Guy Debord and that whole movement.
Sure.
They were talking about the the idea of I guess the whatever it was, they were talking about this machine essentially that took our emotions, took our thoughts and aspirations, took them, commodified them, and then sold them back to us. And that's basically what you're telling us that Google is doing.
It does it so well. You know, think about, you know, broadcast media through most of the 20th century. They were trying their best to guess what we wanted and capture our attention. And they were capturing our attention based on, you know, the shows they were trying to pitch to us. And then they would have advertisers, convince advertisers to tag along with that. And then come up with these really rough estimates about audience size, right? None of that was scientific.
Right.
And so advertisers were wasting a tremendous amount of money. And, you know, the big companies were basically fooling people on both sides, fooling us as customers, as watchers, as viewers, not as customers necessarily, and fooling the advertisers. Now Google comes along and says, you know what, to advertisers, we're going to tell you exactly what people want. We're going to show you a record of what they click on. They actually have to act upon your ads, and we're not going to charge you until someone clicks on it. That's really brilliant, right? And so what it's created though is this imperative that Google understand us both individually and collectively to such a degree that we have such an amazing concentration of knowledge about human desire in those server farms throughout the Pacific Northwest. It's a rich amount of information. The NSA would love to have it. The FBI would love to have it. Every other advertising company in the world would love
and
to have it.
Frankly,
Google's
we don't
got
know.
It.
We don't know if the FBA and the NSA don't have it at this point, frankly.
But it's safe to say that they want it, then they ask for it, and they have the power to get it. And Google, to the best of our knowledge, puts up a good fight to limit that sort of exploitation. You know, but it's one of those things where you know, there's just so much information out there that you can mine from a variety of different sources above and beyond Google. Google isn't the worst offender. It's in some ways just the most successful commercial exploiter of this system. I mean, the worst offender is, you know, probably Facebook, but, but Facebook hasn't figured out how to make money like Google has. So it's a really interesting moment where our, you know, all of our behaviors are being tracked to such a rich degree. And they know so much about us, and we actually don't know that much about them.
But why should we be afraid of this? I mean, it's great. I mean, when I show up on a blog that I like, Google knows that I've been searching around looking for potentially a replacement for my stove, and so I always get these stove ads, and eventually I'll find the stove I want.
It is great for shopping. It's not so great for learning. Every move that Google's made in the last 2 years, for instance, has been to reinforce our expression of our desires, or reinforce our desires. And really, that will do exactly what you described. It's going to focus ads and, in many ways, search results in on the stuff that you've expressed before. So if you're a fan of British cars and I'm a fan of South American jungle cats and you search for Jaguar and I search for Jaguar, we're going to get very different results. And again, if we're talking about everything being about consumption, that's fabulous. Saves us both a tremendous amount of time. But if you're talking about learning, if you're talking about exploring the world, if you're thinking about investigating complicated things, medical phenomena, climate change, political questions, those sorts of things that require deep knowledge, Google may actually be counterproductive for two reasons. One, it's reinforcing our worldview. You know, you may go to 5 blogs. I probably read the same 5 blogs every morning. Somebody else reads a different 5 blogs. And we do a search for a particular aspect of political debate, we're going to get some reinforced lists through Google over time. And that's not necessarily healthy for our political culture. It's not necessarily healthy for our learning environment. So what I'd like people to do is sort of step back and say, you know what? I'm not going to fall for immediate gratification. I'm going to step back and say, Google's fun. Google's good for most things. Google can give me directions to a restaurant. And I'm going to celebrate it for that, and I'm going to continue to use Google. I use Google. I think everybody should. But the real question is, are you going to use it in all ways for all things? Now, if I'm looking into a potential medical condition, I'm not going to want to go to Google. I'm going to want to go to some better references, like actual professionals, for one thing, or the Mayo Clinic site, which has an amazing search engine on it. There are a number of deeper medical research sources that you can find out by talking to a librarian. You know,
what's
so,
problematic
so
with
taking
going,
seriously?
Give me an example. What's problematic with going to Google? My kid's got a rash. What's the problem with going to Google?
Yeah, well, I can give you a real nightmare scenario. Like, let's say that you're a good liberal and you listen to Majority Report, you listen to you watch Rachel Maddow, you read Huffington because Huffington gives you a lot of stuff that reinforces your worldview, right? And all of a sudden you suspect that your child is not developing very well and you start searching for articles on autism. And of course, because you read Huffington a lot and Huffington is optimized for Google, Huffington is going to come up with a lot of ridiculous junk articles, giving you all sorts of misinformation about the sources and research on autism. You know, Huffington is notorious, for instance, for basically spreading lies about autism. And that's one of those things that you can get caught in. Because not everything is good for all things, right? Huffington's great if you want to find out what what Larry David thinks about climate change, but it's not necessarily, it definitely is not where you want to go to investigate serious issues about the world. And that's one of those binds we get in. I don't mean just to pick on Huffington Post, although I could. I have a lot of issues. It really is more about the fact that Google is designed not only to reinforce what you have said you want, what I have said I want, but to also reward websites that design themselves in very specific ways. And Huffington is one of the, 10 or 20 websites in the world that's mastered that design thing. That shouldn't necessarily influence what we think is true or important or powerful, but unfortunately it does. And so if we understand that, we can correct for it. You know, we can say, okay, look, a lot of stuff's going to come up on a website X, Y, or Z because they're really designed for search engine optimization. I now understand search engine optimization because I read the Googleization of everything, and I'm going to make sure I can sort of discount it in my mind and say, oh, that's kind of interesting, but maybe that's not the whole thing. What we've done is we've outsourced decision making to Google. You know, our lives are so busy and we don't have the time or the expertise or the patience to walk through complex issues. And so we say to Google, please help me. Please give me 10 links. I'll only look at the first three, but give me 10 links, and I will work my way through something important and complex based on these 10 links. And I think that's an unhealthy habit that we've gotten into.
There seems to be an analogy to what you're talking about, also with sort of the whole, I guess, rise of apps on smartphones and iPad type of things. Insofar as that we are, the internet brought this promise, and for someone, and I think you and I are pretty close generationally speaking, I grew up, I had four options for entertainment, the three networks and maybe the two UHF channels that I had access to. And then came cable, which theoretically let us as a consumer program ourselves to a certain extent. You know, I now have 30 options, so I have the opportunity to choose and create rather than having to, three options. It was just basically the Brady Bunch on Friday night. That was it. If you didn't want to watch Brady Bunch, no TV.
This may explain why I play Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, there you go. And then cable gives us a little more choices, but the internet then, as in its first incarnation, once you get outside of that AOL sort of realm, you could go anywhere, and there was no sort of, channeling of you anywhere. But now it seems we have come back on some level that we're sort of regressing in some respects, where Google and apps essentially, in particularly apps, but they steer us in certain directions, and we don't know necessarily the forces behind where they're steering us.
Yeah, and we're grateful for the simplification.
Right.
That apps, and in many ways Google presents us, and Facebook. I mean, the beauty of Facebook is the simplification of exploring your day and keeping up with your friends, right? And see, what we did is really interesting, because the story you just told has a media policy and media advocacy part of it too. You know, in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, it was a big movement to create community broadcasting, to public broadcasting, because the idea was the channels were so limited. There was such a fight for over scarcity, right? And now we're in a moment where our problem is not scarcity. Our problem is an abundance of junk, an abundance of distractions, an inability to actually make a truthful claim and have it be accepted as truthful. You know, right. I mean, those are some of our big communication challenges, the exact opposite challenges that we had in the 60s and 70s. And what apps offer us and what Google does to a lesser degree is filter out those distractions, all those choices, right? It masks the abundance and simplifies our way through all of these media influences. And so we're using different filters, right? The challenge for years was, let's get rid of filters, let's increase the number of voices out there. And now we're trying to choose among filters. And some of these filters don't work very well. And all filters are biased in some way, right? And not necessarily politically biased in the way we're used to talking about, but biased toward certain aspects and certain kinds of design, if nothing else, right? And so those are the sorts of things we really have to start paying attention to very closely if we're going to be good citizens, if we're going to be good parents, if we're going to be good students.
Right, because that bias is almost always, if it's not political, it is almost always commercial. And there's very few entities out there that have a bias towards educating and creating better citizens.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with a bias toward the commercial as long as we don't miss it, right? As long as we pay attention, as long as we say, you know, look, Google's going to do great things for me. It's going to do great things for Google, too. And as long as I'm down with that and I'm informed and I've consented, that's great. It can make my life significantly better or at least more convenient. But, you know, really, I can't tell you the number of times I've talked to people, even people who run, you know, on boards of regents, boards of governors of major universities, who've said things like, I don't understand why we're funding the library so much when we have Google. You know, and that's the sort of statement that implies that a private actor has not only the ability but the incentive to do things that are far beyond the bottom line. And I think we've been, for 30 years, we've been fooled into thinking that because private actors and private markets in the textbooks do things more efficiently, that they can actually do everything we need, you know? And I think we need to get back to the recognition. I mean, I thought Hurricane Katrina would do this for us, but apparently it didn't. You know, get back to the recognition that we have public institutions because they're public. Right, because they have a stake in us, and we have a stake in them, and they do very different things. And even if there's some crossover in the effects of how private actors work in the world, you know, basically you can't substitute for the value of a library in a community.
It's a great point. It's a great place to end it. Siva Vaidyanathan, media studies, law at University of Virginia. The book is The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. More stories for you. Tough day for Romney. Tough day for Bonaire. I got to admit, makes a pretty good day for me. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Got another 10 or so minutes to go over some stories. This one covers much of what I have mentioned in the past, but the real story here is who wrote it. Bonaire's views on economy contradicted by indicators and studies. That's a polite way of saying, hey, John Bonaire, he's full of shit. And the best thing is, this is from Bloomberg News. House Speaker John Boehner, giving Wall Street leaders his prescriptions for growing the U.S. economy and reducing the nation's debt, built his case on several assertions that are contradicted by market indicators and government reports. Again, a very polite way of saying, House Speaker John Boehner, speaking to Wall Street, full of total shit. Couldn't be more wrong if we compare it to reality. They mentioned a couple of things. Boehner's statement in his Wall Street speech that government spending is crowding out private investment and threatening the availability of capital runs counter to the behavior of credit markets, Bloomberg says. And it runs counter to all the evidence of how those markets are behaving. So it's not just sort of like a theoretical notion. The idea that the U.S. government spending is somehow making it hard for people to get loans is ridiculous. 10-year treasury notes at an all-time low. 2-year treasury notes, 0.59% at 5 p.m. in New York yesterday, according to Bloomberg. Average spreads on investment-grade corporate bonds have narrowed. A narrowing spread means banks are more willing to lend. And, of course, the only person who backs John Boehner up is disgraced Federal Reserve Board Chairman, disgraced former Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan. To be fair, Bloomberg didn't use those terms. I use disgraced, and frankly, I think that's being polite. Man who brought us the free hand of the market that destroyed the markets. So John Boehner taking it on the chin from Bloomberg News, of course, his morons that will have no impact. I mean John Boehner to go out there and say, hey, I know, listen, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and the sun will not be up until 8 p.m. tonight. And, of course, everybody in the Fox media world would repeat that. And, you know, David Gregory would get on Meet the Press and say, well, he says that's the case. Maybe true, maybe not. Democrats, of course, say that the sun is shining in the middle of the day. That's the recipe for that. But meanwhile, it's not just John Boehner's religious affiliates in the free market fundamentalist world, but also the New York Times reports today that Boehner is going to be giving an address at Catholic University, I believe this weekend, and got slammed, completely slammed. I mean, this letter is stunning, by a group of Catholic professors for his anti-life policies. More than 75 professors at Catholic University and other prominent Catholic colleges. I wonder if we're going to hear from that moron, Donahue, Bill Donahue, from the Catholic League of I sit in an office with one other person and make money by going on TV and getting outraged about supposed slights to Mel Gibson and raise money on that. I don't know if that's the official title of that organization, but... And he says, have written a pointed letter to Mr. Boehner saying that the Republican-supported budget he shepherded through the House, this is the one you'll remember that almost every Republican voted for in to destroy Medicare, will hurt the poor, the elderly, and the vulnerable, and that he's therefore failed to uphold basic Catholic moral teachings. I would add that it's going to hurt everybody, because when you strip health care from elderly or poor, and they go to an emergency room after they have basically avoided getting any care that would prevent them having to go to an emergency room. Yeah, I didn't take my insulin for a long time. I didn't have health insurance. Okay, now I'm in. Now I'm foaming at the mouth and I'm going into a state of shock. But at least I'm getting treatment at the emergency room. Well, when that happens, all of our rates, insurance rates, all of the cost of our medical care goes up because somebody's got to pay for it. And when the doctor goes in there and treats that person who's having a seizure because they haven't had the money to pay for their insulin, or they haven't had comprehensive wellness care, then we pay for it because the doctor puts the cost on us. I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, there's perfect examples that ever. But the letters writers criticize Mr. Bonaire's support for a budget that cut financing for Medicare, Medicaid, and the Women, Infants, Children Nutrition Program. I have an idea. Why don't the women, infants, and children just eat some of the food that they're picking in the fields? Like they're not already. Instead of just waiting for a government. Look at those infants. Pull yourself up by your booty straps. Cuts for the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program while granting tax cuts to the wealthy and corporations. They call such policies anti-life, a particularly biting reference because the phrase is usually applied to politicians and others who support the right to abortion. How did Bonaire respond? I remember when I was baptized. So John Bonaire not having a great day, and neither is
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney is heading to Michigan today, not to claim credit for the bailout and loans to GM, like his fellow conservatives are doing across the country, across the Midwest. General Motors doing swimmingly, like I mentioned the other day, opening up new plants, hiring new people, and guys like Governor John Kasich out there, you know, send his lieutenant governor over to hand, you know, to get a check or to show how happy he is that GM is opening another corporate. I don't know why the Obama administration isn't talking about this on a daily basis. Frankly, I don't know why we don't see ads about this. But we don't. So Mitt Romney going to Michigan today to head off what he knows is going to be one of his biggest hurdles in the Republican field, Republican primary sweepstakes, the clown car race. Now, of course, the other thing that might hurt him is the fact that he's a Mormon, and apparently the base of the Republican Party, the Christian fundamentalists, hate Mormons. I don't know if it's because, like, they wear underwear, something about their underwear. I'm not exactly sure why. I have no idea, because John Smith showed up at the, or Jesus showed up at the bottom of John Smith's bed one night and said, look, there's a secret other Bible. I gave it to the Mayans, and they have it, and you can have it too. Just make sure you lose it after I give it to you, so that nobody can go like, "Hey, what? This is just there's empty pages." Which is not to say, look, personally, it's not to say that Mormonism is any more batshit crazy than Christianity or Judaism, for that matter. The idea of Jesus showing up at the bottom of John Smith's bed is no more crazy than the idea of the Red Sea parting. So, you know, don't get me wrong. It's all crazy. I think it's probably all supposed to be metaphorical, although I'm not sure what the metaphor is when Jesus shows up at the bottom of your bed. Something like, religion will rape you. I don't know what it is, but that's not the point. So Romney travels to Ann Arbor today to deliver what his campaign bills as a major address, laying out its 2012 principles for healthcare reform. This is from the Wall Street Journal op-ed, and then it goes on to excoriate him for being such a flip-flopper, liar, and for being the guy who introduced the country to the individual mandate. And he was the first to put it in practice in a state in Massachusetts. The thing that you remember, the individual mandate, that's the thing that will enslave all of us. Or wait a second, I'm confused. Oh, it's the right to health care which will enslave all of us. That's what Rand Paul said at a hearing in the Senate the other day. I mean, what were you just what were you looking at on the computer, Evan? You playing Minesweeper or?
I've got Minesweeper and Solitaire going at once.
I understand. That is definitely distracting.
All right, here we go.
With regard to the idea of whether or not you have a right to health care, you have to realize what that implies. It's not an abstraction. I'm a physician. That means you have a right to come to my house and conscript me. It means you believe in slavery. It means that you're going to enslave not only me, but the janitor at my hospital, the person who cleans my office, the assistants who work in my office, the nurses. If you have a right to their services, basically, once you imply a belief in a right to someone's services, do you have a right to plumbing? Do you have a right to water? Do you have a right to food? You're basically saying that you believe in slavery. You're saying you believe in taking and extracting from another person. Our founding documents were very clear about this. You have a right to pursue happiness, but there's no guarantee of physical comfort. There's no guarantee of concrete items. In order to give something concrete or someone's service, you got to take it from someone. So there's an implied threat of force. If I'm a physician in your community and you say you have a right to health care, do you have a right to beat down my door with the police, escort me away, and force me to take care of you? That's ultimately what the right to free health care would be. If you believe in a right to health care, you're believing in basically the use of force to conscript someone to do your bidding.
So now, wait a second. Why would it just be the doctors? I mean, if I have a right to health care, don't I have the right to conscript anybody to give me health care? Why is he stopping there? This would not just enslave doctors. This would enslave every single person in this country if there was a right to health care. Now, we all know the slavery that takes place every day in this country. People who work at emergency rooms, for instance, because you have a right to health care from an emergency room. These people are slaves. If you go into an emergency room, you will see the shackles. You'll see the cops who stand there with the whips, whipping the doctors, shackling them, of course. And of course, you know, Rand Paul, this also makes it easier for you to understand his perspective, that you realize that when you insist that a black person has the right to eat at your restaurant if they're behaving in no way that would make you kick out a white person. In other words, if you are forced to serve a black person, you're a slave. You're a slave. You have been enslaved. This is his perspective. I mean, he has more or less said this, actually, that it is a complete infringement upon a business owner it is against the law to discriminate against a black person, or for that matter, it could be a Jew. I guess theoretically, it could be a white person. Could be an Asian person, or just, you know, whatever. You're slaves. You're all slaves. You are all slaves. So I can only say that I'm sad I'm not going to have the opportunity to vote for Rand Paul in this election, and only his kooky dad.
I feel bad for our enslaved brethren in Canada and England. You know, they're all slaves over there.
Oh, like, the doctors. Yes, of course, slave state.
Like,
yes.
How do you is the right to bear arms then the right to go knock on the door of like a gun shop at 3 a.m?
That's right. All people who sell, in fact, all people who do not give you guns
are
slaves.
Slaves.
No, excuse me. All people who do not give you guns should be slaves. How does this work out? Wait a second. If you have the right to bear arms, you have a right to buy guns, then anybody who is not selling you a gun, in fact, anybody who's not giving you a gun, should be taken away immediately. You're all arrested. I'm putting you all on citizen's arrest for not giving me a gun. I don't think he understands what rights mean. I mean, it means that you... What a moron. What a moron. In this case, I think it the idea is that it compels the... It compels the state to provide health care. And, of course, we already have that because, what was that guy's name? Oh, yes, Ronald Reagan, the cartoon figure. We're not going to have a chance to get this. I get so much. We're going to play this in the next. Ronald Reagan was the one, actually, who signed the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act of 1986. Enslaving all of those emergency room. Old man Reagan, the plantation owner. So, meanwhile, Romney's healthcare plan, as spoken about by Ezra Klein, is, of course, a perfect, it's really a perfect Romney bill because it, as expressed in his op-ed, it contradicts itself throughout the entire thing. He wants to allow each state to develop its own system, but he also wants to allow insurance to be sold across state lines. These proposals are perfect opposites, and including both puts Romney on two sides of the same idea. That's actually where Romney feels most comfortable, I got to say. The point of selling insurance across state lines is that it prevents states from managing their insurance options. The idea behind a federal system is that states can manage their insurance options. What's the point of passing a state experimentation act if you're also passing a contamination of state experimentation act? In other words, a state should have the right and the ability to control how health insurance is provided to its citizens. Or insurance flows from other states in which you cannot regulate that. And a federalized unified system, which allows for states to provide their own regulations beyond a federal minimum, give states more eligibility. But as far as I can tell, Romney would have no problem and, in fact, should be out there advocating single payer in Vermont because at this point the state wants it. Every state actor has promoted it. So it'll be interesting to see if somebody asks Romney about Vermont. I doubt it, but it would be interesting. And sadly, as much as Romney is trying to run from his state position by saying, well, let states decide. That's why it was okay for me to do an individual mandate in Massachusetts, because that may not fit for my friends in all the hick states in the rest of the country. And therefore, it would make me eligible by pretending that I am for states' rights. Although, sadly, back in 1994, when Mitt Romney, I think it is the same Mitt Romney, yes, his father was, I think, was not running for Senate in 1994. His father was, I think, governor of Michigan or senator from Michigan. So this was actually the same Romney, but a different Romney. Same but different. Back in 1994, as reported by the Blue Mass Group blog, Romney said he would support a federal individual health care mandate based upon his support for then-Senator John Chafee, a Republican from Rhode Island's bill, which was floated in the Senate. Running for that, Romney said, yeah, I'd vote for that. A federal individual mandate. It's interesting. Ezra Klein sums it up quite well. Romney here made the only move left to him and the and frankly to the Republican Party. A capsule history of health care reform is that Democrats began with single payer and Republicans, led by Richard Nixon, countered with an employer-based system. Then in the 1990s, Democrats proposed an employer-based system, and the Republicans countered with an individual mandate, which Romney actually passed in Massachusetts in 2005. Then in 2009, Democrats proposed a system based on an individual mandate, and the Republicans countered with a vague promise to repeal and replace. They were out of ideas.
Hey, what happened? So now they're just running around with chickens basically saying that if you have health care for all, you are enslaving everybody. You're all slaves. Now listen, I'm putting out a call to all you slaves who are not selling me guns or giving me guns. As you know, I have a right to bear arms. And if I'm not if you're not giving me a gun, you are basically like escaped slaves. You're runaway slaves. The two of you right here, runaway slaves. Where's my gun? Where's my gun?
I'll go get one for you.
Yeah,
I hear
right.
Walmart's got a bunch of them now.
I'm gonna put one of those bracelets on your ankle. I'll let you get out of my sight. All right, we got a lot more. When we come back, I'll play the Time Travel Kids and the origin of World War II. This is part of Mike Huckabee's cartoon plan to change history. Maybe he could put Mitt Romney in one of those cartoons, and Mitt Romney can go back and pretend like he never did any of those things. All right, folks, join me on the flip side. You can call at 646-257-3920 or simply I am at Majority FM. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be jam-packed. Morgan Spurlock, the guy who does the movie reviews, and Cliff Schecter. Can't forget it. All right. Be right back on the other half, the better half, the flip side. Majority Report post-show.